From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. This week, we're starting off in a place that's kind of a paradox.
Oh, that looks like a fountain down there.
Yeah, I think there are some. There's like a little lagoon. Oh, man, that's not the river, that's the lagoon.
It's in the United States, but it's also sort of not. We sent our reporters, Michael Corey and Catherine Miskowski, there.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wait, is that the fence?
The U.S.-Mexico border fence.
Yeah, that's the fence.
That's it?
Yeah.
Get out.
They're surprised because, well, it doesn't look like an international boundary. It looks more like something you'd find at a gated community that's taking security a little too seriously. It's a 15-foot-tall black steel fence with gates. And the gates, they're standing wide open. You can pretty much come and go as you please.
So we just walked through the fence, but we're still in the United States.
Yeah, we are in Texas, but we are kind of walled off from the rest of the country right now.
And one more thing. They're standing in the middle of a golf course. So how are Catherine and Michael in Texas, but walled off from the rest of the country? Let me explain. The border is actually the Rio Grande. Then there's a no man's land, and then you hit the border fence. But in this case, that no man's land is the Eagle Pass Municipal Golf Course.
It's like this pleasant, small public golf course, and there's like birds calling behind us, and it doesn't feel like this is the front lines of a border war or anything.
But the golf course is the front lines.
We can see Mexico about a quarter mile that way.
Catherine and Michael walk down to where the real action is, on the bank of the Rio Grande.
Now we got Border Patrol coverage.
Wait, where are they?
That truck right there.
Oh, good thing I have my passport.
Next, an airboat comes buzzing down the river, carrying a strike team of Border Patrol agents. And they're heavily armed.
Were they wearing like commando gear?
Yeah, that was outrageous. They were like in full like SWAT camouflage.
Yeah, that was a Border Patrol airboat.
President Trump has big plans to build an impassable wall between the U.S. and Mexico. But in places like Eagle Pass, Texas, the reality is more complicated. There already is a border fence here. It goes around the golf course and continues down the road, but it peters out after a few miles. Now, for the rest of the country, Trump's wall is kind of an abstract idea. But people in Eagle Pass live life on both sides of the wall every day, even when they just want to work on their swing.
That's what it sounds like when a golf ball hits the border fence.
It's like a metaphor, guys.
Do it again.
Today, we're going to take you to a lot of places like Eagle Pass, where the idea of a border wall clashes with the reality of building one. Part of the reason is we're not exactly sure what Donald Trump will do. Since he's been in office and from the very first day of his campaign, he's talked about the wall a lot, but he hasn't offered a lot of specifics.
We will build the wall.
Oh, we're going to build the wall. Don't worry about it. We're building the wall.
35 to 40 feet up in the air. That's high. That's a real wall.
A great wall. And nobody builds walls better than me, believe me. It'll be bigger and better and stronger. And people aren't going to Home Depot and buying a ladder and walking right off. This, not this wall.
The wall is getting designed right now. A lot of people say, oh, Trump was only kidding with the wall. I wasn't kidding. I don't kid.
How serious is he? The government has already started the bidding process to get a wall built, and they're moving at lightning speed. Customs and Border Protection will only have 10 days to review the first round of bids and plans to award contracts by mid-April. The cost could top $20 billion. Reveal's Michael Corey is back from the golf course and joins us to make sense of it all. He's mapped out the entire U.S.-Mexico border and figured out where there's already fencing in place. And Mike, can you start off by telling us what sort of barriers are on the border right now?
Okay, so there's 2,000 total miles of border between the U.S. and Mexico. Right now, there's 700 miles of fence, but some of that is double and triple layer fencing. So it actually comes out to only about 650 miles of border have fence on them today.
All right, so how much are we talking about adding?
Well, I mean, it's still a little bit unclear. We know for sure that the administration is going to replace at least 25 miles of old border fence, but that's just replacing fence that's already there. There's been some leaked documents out there that say that theoretically they could fence the whole border. I just don't see how you're going to do that, how you're going to build 1,300 miles of fence in a single president's term.
Okay, so do you think that they're actually going to build a wall? Like, in my mind, when I hear Trump talk about a wall, the first thing I think about is the Great Wall of China, like something like massive that stretches across the border. Is that realistic?
I think he's going to build something. But everything we have right now is a fence. It's pretty clearly a fence. If something is tall and metal and has holes in it, that's a fence. I don't know what else to call it. The federal government has left a lot of wiggle room since Trump's election as to what they mean by a wall. If they want to, they could call the existing fence a wall. That's within the definition that they set. But that's not really what Trump talked about on the campaign trail. I mean, he even said before, oh, it's going to be this precast concrete thing that doesn't have any holes. I certainly don't think they're going to do the whole thing that way. That presents a lot of logistical challenges. Also, the Border Patrol doesn't like that because they can't see through it. They can't see what's going on the other side. So they actually prefer fence that you can see through.
Okay, so we know Trump wants to build a wall, but what are the strategic purposes behind putting these barriers on the border?
I would tell you that the wall has two basic purposes. There's this one actual tactical useful purpose in small areas where it does seem like building fence drives people to try to cross in other places besides where the fence is. That can be really dangerous. I mean, people get pushed into the desert where there's less fence and die in large numbers. But I think it's hard to argue that that doesn't work in that sense. The other thing, though, is that it looks really good on a map from a 30,000-foot view to have this nice line that says you've got the border fence. I think this is the political purpose, to say that you drew that line all the way across the border.
That was Reveal's Michael Corey. We'll hear more from him in a bit, but to give you a better sense of what the border wall is and what might be coming, we're going to take you all along the U.S.-Mexico border, starting at the Pacific Ocean, where San Diego meets Tijuana. Some places along here, you can see the oldest border fences still in use, corrugated metal plates about 10 feet high. Now, these are leftover aircraft landing mats from the Vietnam War era. Helicopter pilots use them as portable touchdown pads. Now, they're the first line of defense along the U.S. border. Reveal's Andrew Becker takes a guided tour with someone who knows the territory.
I'm driving along the U.S.-Mexico border with Sean Moran. He's a veteran Border Patrol agent and spokesman for the National Border Patrol Council, the union that represents more than 16,000 Border Patrol agents. It's also one of two federal employee unions that endorsed Donald Trump's candidacy. The president personally thanked Sean's union for its support. Sean says he's confident the president will fulfill his promise to build something, whether it's a heavily fortified, highly visible wall or something else.
It's to, really just show your presence out there and, prevent people in the first place from trying to get across the border.
Right out there.
Sean twists a knob on his radio, and a metal gate slides open, allowing us to drive in between the old and the new fence. The original fence is the old steel landing mat that was military surplus until some resourceful agents welded it together decades ago. The newer second fence is steel mesh, much of it lined top and bottom with razor wire that makes this stretch of border look like Fortress America. That presence includes stadium bright floodlights, video cameras, motion sensors, night vision scopes. None of that, Sean says, stops the flow of fence cutters leading groups headed north.
It's got so many patches. It's like a quilt, but keeps our fence crew busy at all times.
Over the 20 years Sean's worked as an agent, the Border Patrol has tripled its annual spending to nearly $4 billion a year. In that time, the border buildup has effectively shut down illegal crossings around Tijuana, but people still try to get across.
This is a current hotspot for Haitians and Cubans trying to cross the border and make it in and request asylum.
Haitians?
Haitians.
Cubans?
There are 5,000 Haitians in Tijuana right now trying to get into the United States.
How is that working?
They are coming up from Brazil, and the vast majority of them are working off the exact same script when they're claiming a credible fear, when in reality they're...
It's on the 127-41, 127.
They're trying to escape poor economic conditions.
Sometimes people on the Mexican side take advantage of higher ground to pelt Sean's fellow agents with rocks, distracting them so people can slip past. Other times, migrants wait for nature to overtake the Border Patrol's technology. On rainy days, Footing in the riverbed allows them to swim while chase vehicles spin their wheels in the mud. On other days,
the fog blinds us. So it's, you know, you're going back to getting out on foot, listening, waiting for sensors to go off, hoping that, you know, it may dissipate a bit so that we can see them.
Sean says, because this stretch of border is so close to cities and the smuggling contacts who live on both sides,
I don't know that you're ever going to see it drop to zero. The heart of smuggling in Mexico is always going to be Tijuana. And people are going to make their way here first, even if it's just as a staging area to get somewhere else with a smuggling organization. And if you don't have a whole lot of money to pay a smuggling organization, they might try here.
The fence did its job here, as intended, sealing off an urban area and pushing migrant traffic into more remote areas. That was supposed to make it easier for Border Patrol agents to catch them. Instead, it changed the nature of smuggling.
Two hits on the 107, port 2, 107.
Now, we're going to travel east along the border from San Diego to our next stop in southeast Arizona. On this 460-mile stretch, there's 225 miles of what the Border Patrol calls pedestrian fence. These metal fences range from 10 feet to 18 feet. Then you have 179 miles of much shorter vehicle fences, and they look like cross wooden planks positioned low like playground seesaws. With all those miles of fences, sometimes double layers of them, the border doesn't just go through the desert. It backs right up against people's yards. We meet back up with Andrew Becker. He's with a rancher who lives right on the border.
I first met up with rancher John Ladd back in 2015.
My family came in 1896.
We met on his 16,000-acre Arizona ranch that butts up against the tiny border town of Naco. John's straight out of an old Western, updated for the 21st century. The 61-year-old wears a bushy silver mustache and a brown cowboy hat. He carries a smartphone instead of a six-shooter. He took me out in his red pickup, bumping over a rolling dirt road that fronts the border fence. John showed me where trucks got the better of his fence again and again.
This is an area where they're ramping.
So wait. Describe it again.
They got big metal ramps coming up from the south side up to the top and then ramps on this side that they drive the ramp the trucks through.
Yep, they would drive right over the fence. John told me that people also go through the fence on foot.
The unique part of our ranch is it's 3 miles wide, and from the border to the highway, it takes about 40 minutes to walk it. You jump the wall, you walk 40 minutes, you get a ride, and you go wherever you want to go.
This was in June when the cicadas were out on the ranch. Hovering in the sky about 30 miles away, a surveillance blimp kept an eye on the border for low-flying aircraft from Mexico, mainly looking for drug runners. On the ground, John was dealing with a wave of what's known as drive-thrus.
A drive-thru is a full-size pickup full of dope coming, cutting the wall down and driving through the ranch to get to the highway. We've had 47 trucks go through the ranch that haven't been caught over 3.5 years. And, you know, that's unacceptable. In my opinion, that's an embarrassment.
That was then, and this is now. I recently visited John to see if anything had changed since Trump was elected. The first thing he shows me is a new fence under construction. It's 2.5 miles long, 18 feet high, made of steel, concrete, and rebar. It isn't as fortified as the U.S. border at Tijuana, but once it's done, John says drug runners will have to try a little harder.
The 5-foot-tall plate at the top is so if they lean a shorter ladder up against it, they can't get a handhold to climb over the top. So they are going to have an 18-foot ladder to do this.
The smuggling traffic has changed since our last visit. There have been a lot fewer marijuana drive-thrus, which John says is good.
But that increased the mule traffic, the human backpackers. And so, you know, right now it's probably 2 or 3 a week is of the mule loads going through, and that's increased quite a bit over the last 5 years. It used to be 1 a week, and then since they stopped the vehicles, now they're backpacking it more.
Whatever fence, barrier, or wall was built here, John's convinced there's a better way to keep drug traffickers and other smugglers off his land.
Putting additional agents up here, and the Border Patrol can do it. They have the people that can do it. If they're allowed to do it from our Congress, I think we'll have the problem solved. If that works, then I's a hero. If it doesn't work, then I'm just another dumb cowboy.
John Ladd might get his wish for more help on the border. President Trump last month said he wants to add 5,000 more Border Patrol agents and 10,000 more Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers. One place the Border Patrol has been directing a lot of attention recently is in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas. That's where we're headed next, to the town of Los Ebonos. It's about 800 miles south and east from John Ladd's property. Along the way, there's 103 miles of pedestrian fence and 123 miles of vehicle fence. But in Los Ebonos, there is no fence. Reveal's Michael Corey tells us why.
We're driving into Los Ebonos with Aurora Mirta Flores Trigo. She's a 67-year-old who lives just outside town. She warns me to watch my speed.
See, here you have to stay at 45.
Here's why. The streets are crawling with the U.S. Border Patrol's white and green trucks. And then there's the state police cars. A couple hundred feet above us floats an aerostat. That's a small surveillance blimp tethered to the ground.
Another blimp. Apparently, Thursday is blimp day.
If you saw this in a city, you'd think some kind of major raid was brewing. Here, it's just another morning.
Los Ebonos is a very, very small little village. Most of the pioneers are all gone.
But many of Aurora's relatives have stayed here. As we drive by, she points out their houses.
This cousin is mine, and this is my brother here. He's also in the list.
The list she's talking about was on a Justice Department document that showed up in her mailbox in January. It told her the federal government was suing 58 people and her extended family. That's how eminent domain works. The government sues you to force the sale of the property.
It's farther a little down. It's going to be through here, yes, right here. Yeah.
We turn off on a dirt road so we can get closer to the 16 acres the family's owned for over a century. The government doesn't want all the land, but it wants to build a section of the border fence on a one-acre swath right through the middle.
These people from wherever they're from, they don't know what this land means to the family.
Hundreds of other people do know what Aurora's family faces. In other border states, the feds already owned most of the land where they built the fence. But in South Texas, many landowners have lived here for generations. So the government had to sue. We looked up court records from all the eminent domain suits the Department of Justice filed against landowners. In South Texas alone, it filed about 320 cases in the last decade. Since the late 1990s, the government has spent at least $40 million on land for the border fence. Here's the bottom line. If the government wants your property, eventually it will take it. But some landowners hold out as long as they can, including Aurora's cousin, Alida Flores Garcia.
Los Ebonos will shine tonight. Los Ebonos will shine. When the moon goes up and the sun goes down, Los Ebonos will shine. That was my mother's little verse.
10 years ago, the federal government tried to build a fence on Alida's property, but she held out. And eventually, the government walked away. It's unclear whether the Trump administration will try again. If it does,
the majority of my land is going to be on the other side.
The barrier would cut Alida off from most of her 30 acres, including her favorite spot, a little riverside beach with shiny sand.
And I just park along the riverbeds and I just listen to the radio. I hear the sound of the trees and the smell of the water, and it's so relaxing.
It is nice on the river. But all that surveillance is in Los Ebonos for a reason.
I'll be honest, we did have the drugs coming in. We did have illegal immigrants coming in, but with no danger.
They're just passing through, she says, and they don't bother her. She's much more worried about the idea of a wall on her property. And all that ground and air surveillance that outsiders find kind of creepy, she loves it.
Technology has really helped our little town here. Feet on the ground has also helped us a lot. And I would rather give my taxpayers' money to something like that than to a wall that if the river hits it, I don't think it's going to be there anymore.
The Rio Grande twists and turns here, and surrounds Los Ebenos on three sides. When the river floods, as it did in 2010, the village turns into an island. And that risk of flooding is what ultimately chased the government away, and not just because it might destroy the fence. Any flooding that spills into Mexico along the Rio Grande violates an international treaty. It's one reason previous administrations gave up trying to build a border fence here.
As I said, as a river gives, the river takes away.
That story was from Reveal's Michael Corey with producer Catherine Miskowski. It's about 100 miles from Los Ebenos to the end of the U.S.-Mexico border. In between, there are 55 miles of tall metal pedestrian fence and none of the shorter vehicle fence. Along this stretch, short segments of the fence with varying degrees of security in between continue eastward until the final checkpoint between Brownsville and Matamoros. We've now taken you from the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico, just shy of 2,000 miles. When we come back, we'll look at another international barrier that Trump has held up as a model for what he wants in this country. You're listening to Reveal.
Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For as little as $32 a week, you can work with an experienced, licensed therapist handpicked just for you. On Talkspace, you can send text, audio, and video messages to your therapist and talk about your life or just work on feeling a bit happier. To sign up or learn more, go to Talkspace.com/reveal. And to show your support for this podcast, use code REVEAL to get $30 off your first month. That's code REVEAL at Talkspace.com/reveal.
Hi, this is Jim Briggs. I'm the lead sound designer and engineer, and I also write some of the music here for REVEAL. Some of the music that you've been hearing this hour is not just music. It's actually the wall data that we've collected while reporting this episode turned into music. So when you hear this, that's a tall pedestrian barrier. And when you hear this, that's a short fence that's meant to keep vehicles from crossing the border. To find out more about how Michael Corey and I made this sonification, head on over to revealnews.org/wall sound.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. We've heard a lot about challenges of building a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. But other countries have put up similar barriers. President Trump often points to tiny Israel for proof that walls can keep people out.
Do walls work? Just ask Israel. They work.
With the praise and plans of President Trump in mind, Israeli companies that make high-tech border barriers are now eyeing the U.S. government as a potential huge new customer. One of those companies is called Magal S3. Magal's promotion shows different kinds of detection technology. Sensors that are set off by hand touching a fence, microwaves that pick up movement nearby, and in this video, a roundish gizmo with rechargeable batteries called RoboGuard.
RoboGuard is an agile surveillance robot that travels on the monorail. It can also respond promptly to intrusion alerts.
Stay away from the fence.
We don't know if RoboGuard is coming to a fence near you. We do know that Magal has expressed its interest in the Mexico Wall project with the U.S. government. We'll hear from Magal's CEO in our next story, reported by Reveal's Emily Harris. She spent 3 years as a foreign correspondent in Israel before returning to the U.S. last summer. With help from producer Mark Baker, who's on the ground there, she has this up-close look at Israel's walls.
Israel's best-known wall is part of about 300 miles of barrier that twists between Israel and the West Bank. It's a combination barrier. About 10% is concrete wall, and about 90% is high-tech wire mesh fence. It often cuts deep into land that Palestinians claim for a future country of their own.
How do you do?
Okay.
Our producer Mark met up with a former Israeli army colonel, Danny Tirza. They drove to a spot where the tall concrete wall switches to a fence that's loaded with electronic sensors.
We are just in the place that the fence is
kissing the wall.
Some people call Danny the father of this barrier. He decided where it goes. He figured out where to put the fences and where to build the walls.
In some places, the Palestinians were shooting from their areas toward a traffic that runs inside Israel. So I had to construct concrete walls to protect the traffic from the snipers.
Where this barrier is, wall, it is big. That's one of the things President Trump says he wants. Most stretches of wall in Israel's West Bank barrier are nearly 30 feet tall. Danny talks in meters. That's 9 meters high.
Some people says to me, can you make it some shorter? Well, really, at first I tried to construct only 6 meters high. But 6 meters, if you climb it, some people can jump. 9 meters, nobody jumps.
They have to climb down somehow, which Danny says gives soldiers time to show up. Of course, Danny didn't climb the wall when he was talking with us, but within 5 minutes, Israeli soldiers showed up anyway.
1 minute, the soldiers here, they just want us to see. Okay, okay, the soldiers are very curious about what we're doing here.
He says it's good they're curious because a fence or a wall only works with a lot of human backup. Armed Israeli security forces work both sides of the West Bank barrier. Danny says that's why it's successful, even in places it's not fully built.
We have soldiers and border police in these places, so therefore you cannot cross today from the West Bank to Israel unless you cross a checkpoint.
Except you can cross without passing a checkpoint.
It's an early start.
Yeah.
Before dawn recently, Mark and his interpreter headed to the Palestinian village of Wadi Fukin. It's in the West Bank. It's tucked below an Israeli settlement and almost next to the official boundary line with Israel. This is one spot where the barrier has not been built.
We're on the hillside now. And we're heading down into the valley.
The village sits in a narrow valley that's surrounded by rocky, rounded hills. It's a 20-minute climb through fields and forest to enter Israel. There's no border guards along the way, no checkpoint. And every workday, Palestinian laborers come from all over the West Bank to take that walk. Mark walked with them.
Okay. We've come to the place where there are about 15 men and 4 or 5 vans dropping them off, maybe 20 men, and they're all making their way up through a rough hill with some grass and rocks and olive trees. And we can actually see people coming from over hills in the distance, making their way in our direction up towards the border. And do the police ever come along here?
Sometimes.
Is this area famous then as a place to cross?
Yeah,
it's like everyone knows that.
So basically, the question was like, you've been doing this for years,
mm-hmm.
and they never knew that you're doing this. He says, no, they know this, and they want us to get in to work and to do, you know, the building stuff and construction, but they have to make it hard for us to get inside.
That's one way you can sneak from the West Bank into Israel. Other Palestinians have used ladders to scale the wall and ropes to slide down, or they've clipped the fence and snuck through the hole. Like the U.S. depends on Mexican workers, Israel needs Palestinians to do jobs like construction and restaurant work. And even though there are still ways over, around, and through, most Israelis say the West Bank barrier has helped lower the number of Palestinian terrorist attacks done inside Israel. A tougher Israeli barrier to cross runs 150 miles along Israel's desert border with Egypt. Before a high-tech fence covered the whole thing, tens of thousands of people entered Israel there without permission. Many of them had left wars in Eritrea and Sudan.
When Israel constructed the Egyptian border, basically it solved our problem.
This is Sar Kursh. He heads the Israeli company Magal S3. He built the Israeli-Egyptian border fence.
It took us 2 years to complete the project, and then the number of illegal immigrants dropped dramatically from 2,000 on average per month to less than 10 per month.
There are other factors, like detention in Israel, that might play a role. But these are the kind of numbers that President Trump is after. He regularly praises Israel's walls as 99.9% successful. But a few years after this fence along Israel's border with Egypt was finished, the number of people who managed to cross it began to creep up again. So Israel kept building. More sensors went in, and Israel just finished raising 10 miles of this fence from 16 to 26 feet high.
Many Eritreans and Sudanese looking to cross the desert towards Israel's border with Egypt paid smugglers to help them, which is exactly what's happening along the U.S.-Mexico border. Reveal's Andrew Becker asked a veteran human smuggler in Tijuana for his take on the planned wall.
The smuggler I meet up with asked that I not name him and told me to call him Juan. We drive from downtown Tijuana to a motley hillside neighborhood where homes crammed together and topped with corrugated metal roofs have a front yard view of the border. It's where Juan began smuggling people across the line when he was 14 years old, more than four decades ago. He directs me down a rutted dirt road that parallels the border fence. From this high point overlooking the most fortified part of the border, Juan keeps a close eye on both the weather and the agents on the other side.
This is el muro.
This is the border wall. It's really easy to cross. All you need is a ladder and an old mattress so you don't get cut by the second wire fences. It's difficult for people who haven't crossed, but with the adrenaline and all that, it seems small.
From here, we can see much of the city below, past green hills in the Tijuana River Valley and out to the ocean. The Border Patrol's cameras mounted on a tower in the U.S. appear to watch us. Juan says a wall won't stop him, but more Border Patrol agents could.
Sir, él dice que va a militarizar la frontera.
I think maybe it will get harder if he militarizes the border. That might be a little difficult.
So a wall itself doesn't concern you. It's bringing in more Border Patrol agents and more surveillance and more technology that might make things more difficult for you.
We'll see.
Juan closely guards his secrets, his tactics, routes, and even the Border Patrol agent who he says helps him out. Even then, Juan says these days, crossing here in Tijuana is for the few who are intrepid enough or desperate enough to take the risk. But if they want to cross here, well, his job is to be creative.
I'm going to be looking around, looking for ways to get in, and if I'm lucky, I'll get through. That's what Trump doesn't know, that the same Border Patrol agents will betray him and let us pass without asking for money.
For those who can pay, Juan sends groups of 5 to 7 migrants through the rugged arroyos and arid mountains of the Sonoran Desert that extends from northern Mexico to Arizona. The journey takes a week. The going rate to be smuggled by foot is around $6,500. It costs $15,000 to be stuffed in a trunk and driven across. Juan says rising smuggling fees offers more money to tempt agents willing to take a bribe and look the other way.
As the saying goes, we Mexicans are united. I have a bunch of family I can ask for favors, like, say, cousins with immigration. And there we go. You just find a way. The immigration officer is human. If he sees I have my wife and 2 kids, and they're disheveled and skinny and look like they need to eat, he'll look the other way. I've seen it. We're grateful to those people.
That's Reveal's Andrew Becker. Thanks to Mariana Martinez, who helped produce that story. Another harsh critic of Trump's plan to build the wall and make Mexico pay for it is former Mexican President Vicente Fox. I spoke with him recently, and we can't play most of that on the radio because, well, Fox likes to use some colorful language. But you can listen to it on our podcast by going to revealnews.org/podcast. You're listening to Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey, listeners, Julia B. Chan here, Reveal's digital editor. If you're like us, you might be more than a little obsessed with podcasts. But there's still plenty of people out there who've never even listened to one before. We, along with our friends at PRX, NPR, and other podcasts around the country, are teaming up to spread the word about how great podcasts really are. Want to help? It's easy. Think of someone you really care about. What podcast would they really love? Tell them about it. And if they need help, show them how they can listen. Then tell us what you'd recommend using the hashtag tripod. Now, I've seen people using it across networks, on Facebook, on Twitter, and even on Instagram. And that's hashtag TRYPOD. Thanks for spreading the word.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. This hour, we're taking a hard look at the U.S.-Mexico border and the wall that President Donald Trump has promised to build. There's already some kind of barrier on nearly 700 miles of the border, and it's not just stopping people from crossing. That half-purr, half-growl comes from an ocelot. It's a small wildcat that looks like a miniature leopard.
Come on, make your little growl again. It's so cute.
And that's a woman filming an ocelot at a zoo in Belize.
Yeah, no one can be scared of that little growl.
Fewer than 100 of these cats still live in the wild in the U.S. At least some of them live along the Texas-Mexico border, specifically the Rio Grande Valley. The area is home to dozens of varieties of threatened birds and animals. And scientists say that a border fence is speeding up their extinction. Kia Collier of the Texas Tribune has more.
Sonia Najera is one of the lucky few to have seen an ocelot in the wild.
You'll see them. I have seen some sometimes crossing the roads during the day, moving. It's extremely rare. Yeah, I'm very lucky.
Sonia's a biologist with the Nature Conservancy, and she works at what's called the Southmost Preserve near Brownsville, Texas. She got here about 10 years ago, just as the federal government was making plans to build a border fence straight through the property.
It was really difficult to see. It was difficult to think it's happening. Did it set us back? Sure. But we have a lot of work to do. The conservation doesn't stop.
The fence went up in 2010, and Sonia says ever since, it's made life tough for the ocelot and other animals here.
And so when you have a barrier like this, it makes animals having to go further than their known territory, where there's danger of collision with vehicles, and so that puts a stress.
The Border Patrol activity doesn't help. The government built a road along the fence, and trucks and ATVs constantly pass by. The fence is 18 feet tall with iron posts 2 inches apart. Pointy caps on top of the posts give the fence a medieval flair. But Homeland Security did try and help the ocelot find its way through. Every 500 feet or so, there are bigger openings at the bottom of the fence. Sonia calls them cat holes. My colleague Nina Satija and I had a hard time spotting them.
Okay, I actually honestly don't see it.
Sonia grabs Nina's shoulders and positions her right in front of the cat hole.
That's a okay. Hole meant...
8.5 by 11 inches.
Like the size of a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's supposed to be big enough for cats to crawl through?
Yes.
Like an ocelot would be able to crawl through that.
And a coyote, yes.
Wow.
How are they supposed to find it, though?
Yeah, that's a good question.
To give us a sense of the ideal habitat for ocelots, Sonia takes us a little further into the preserve. We're less than a mile away from the barren border fence area, but all of a sudden, we're in a lush green forest.
The wind, you can hear. I mean, the sound here is really nice.
The wind is blowing through trees here known as sable palms. Their leaves fan out like a peacock's plume. The trees are a lot more majestic than the palms you'd see in Hawaii or Beverly Hills. A lot of the Rio Grande Valley used to look like this, but almost all of it has been lost to development. The Southmost Preserve would normally be protected by legislation like the Endangered Species Act. But in order to build the border fence quickly, Congress let Homeland Security ignore all of those laws. It also waived requirements to study the environmental impacts of a border fence. That left scientists scrambling.
We didn't really have the luxury of doing a before-after experimental study to really look at places with and without walls.
That's Aaron Flesch, a biologist at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He found the existing border fence has affected animals like the bighorn sheep and pygmy owl, which only flies a few feet above the ground. Now he's worried about jaguars.
You know, jaguars will go extinct in the U.S. if they build a hardened border wall. And we've had a couple jaguars recently in the U.S., and the reason they're here is because they walk across the border from Mexico.
A handful of small studies has been done on the impacts of the border fence on wildlife. They all found the same thing. By chopping up habitat, the border fence makes it harder for animals to find food, water, and mates. But humans, they can still get through.
You know, the big thing here, though, honestly, is the only species that we know that's going to make it through the wall are people. You know, people are really good at using tools. We build ladders. You know, we go up and over things.
For Aaron Flesch, the fence is damaging the environment for no good reason. And that's not the only irony. A lot of the border fence in Texas actually runs through land that had been set aside for conservation. Our last stop was a national wildlife refuge on the Texas-Mexico border. We met up with Scott Nickel of the Sierra Club.
That refuge was meant to be a wildlife corridor for endangered ocelots.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service bought this land about 40 years ago. It's been buying up land like this for the last century to protect habitat. It's federal property, which is exactly what made it so convenient when another federal agency came along with a different agenda.
Customs and Border Protection and Department of Homeland Security knew that condemning private property was going to be a very difficult and time-consuming and expensive process. So they targeted areas that were already federally owned. They refer to it in their emails as low-hanging fruit.
The result of plucking this low-hanging fruit is pretty bizarre. The border fence runs the length of this refuge. Then, where the refuge ends and non-federal land starts, the fence just stops. And it doesn't pick up again for another 10 miles.
Thanks to Kia Collier and Nina Satija with our partner, the Texas Tribune, for bringing us that story. By the way, we did reach out to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and asked if they're studying the environmental impacts of Trump's proposed border wall. At this time, they told us they are not. So far this hour, we've heard about the logistical, legal, and environmental issues with putting up more barriers on the border. Now, a more intimate look at some of the consequences of building up the border. Here's Stan Alcorn.
When Ann Norris was growing up in the suburbs of San Francisco, she didn't travel, and so she didn't have a passport. But when she was 17, she took a field trip to Tijuana.
I got a letter from my mom giving me permission. It was a notarized letter, but still, it was that's all you needed. I didn't even have a picture ID, you know?
It was a simpler time, 1997.
Did you have any ideas about border security?
None. None. Never thought about it, never cared about it. Never was a part of my life.
Until years later, she met Rick. Anne was still living in California. Now in her 20s, she was a single mom making ends meet as an accountant at a homeowners association. And Rick worked at a sushi restaurant in the same small shopping center. Each morning at the coffee shop, they'd exchange looks. Until eventually, and decided to walk over and say hi.
He looked shocked, and he just kind of stuttered, and I think he was more nervous because he really didn't speak a lot of English.
Rick, full name Jose Ricardo Garay Garay, was from El Salvador. He'd initially snuck across the U.S.-Mexico border, but Ann says when they met, he was here legally after getting what's called temporary protected status. It's like an emergency visa that Salvadorans became eligible for after earthquakes hit the country. Rick didn't speak a lot of English, and Ann didn't speak a lot of Spanish. But the two of them connected through Michael Jackson. The first time she went over to Rick's house, Billie Jean came on, and he got so into it, he knocked over a huge cup of ice water.
And it just went flying everywhere, and it was just, he just laughed, and he danced around and picked up the water, and it was just, it was fun. He didn't take life too seriously, which was kind of a breath of fresh air.
Ann and Rick fell in love, moved in together, had a son. But then Rick's temporary protected status expired, and in 2009, he was deported back to El Salvador. Ann remembers how hard it was on their son, Andrew.
He'd run to the door when he would hear a car, and he would try to open the door, and he couldn't in his little chubby hands. You know, he was still only, he wasn't two yet, and he would cry. That was the hardest part, was watching that.
Rick was determined to get back to his son, even though it would mean crossing the border illegally again. Ann's image of the border was from her high school field trip to Mexico, so she thought he could just get in a car and drive across the border without getting stopped, like she did.
I literally thought that that's what was going to happen. He just said it was impossible. I remember him saying, it's impossible to come through California. It's impossible.
It looked impossible to cross the border in California in 2009 because of the Fortress America security you heard about earlier. Agents, floodlights, cameras. So instead, Rick smugglers took him some 300 miles east, somewhere near this dirt road at the southern edge of Arizona.
We're standing at where the wall ends.
That's Marietta Valet. For more than a decade, she's been part of a group that brings food and water and medical care to migrants trying to cross this desert. It's called No More Deaths. She's standing at the end of a 12-foot-tall border fence. And beyond the fence?
It's just rocks and cactus. And every direction, all you can see is mountains.
Mountains, cactus, and the scorching Arizona sun. This is what you get when you try to avoid the border patrol. Like the wall, the landscape itself is a barrier and a symbol.
This place where we're standing, where the wall ends, sends a strong message that the desert is doing the enforcement work for our country. And the desert has been, this beautiful desert, has been made into a weapon.
On the Tuesday Rick started walking, temperatures here hit 93 degrees. Ann had expected him back home that weekend, but days and then weeks passed. Ann says she just knew that he was dead, even before she got a call from a relative of Rick's in El Salvador, telling her the friends Rick was crossing with lost him in the night when he was weak and dehydrated.
I envisioned him laying there watching people walk away from him, knowing he was going to die. And how horrible he must have felt, and how lonely he must have felt, and how scared he must have been, and he was alone. Knowing he would never see Andrew again, and that's all he wanted, you know? Those thoughts can really, really, they hurt.
8 years later, no trace of Rick has been found. No one knows how many migrants have walked into the Arizona desert, never to be seen again. But there is someone who knows how many of the dead have been recovered. Dr. Greg Hess.
Hi. How are you?
My colleague Scott Pham went to visit him.
Thanks for meeting a little bit earlier than you usually do.
Greg Hess is the Pima County Medical Examiner. He's in charge of analyzing human remains found in three of Arizona's four border counties. Back in the 90s, his office found 10 or 15 undocumented border crossers each year. In the 2000s, as human smugglers shifted from California to Arizona, that number jumped to 10 or 15 a month. In 2005, they actually had to build a new walk-in cooler for human remains.
Hopefully, this is the key that works for it.
It's the size of a two-car garage.
Yes, it is. Okay. What was this room like at the height around 2010?
Well, it was full, and it was loud, and it was cold.
In 2010, the year after Rick went missing, 223 bodies were recovered. It was the most on record. But that actually understates it, because the total number of people crossing here had gone way down. The desert has been getting deadlier. And you can see one reason why on these maps Greg has.
So this map shows red dots, and it shows Pima County.
Red dots mark where bodies were found. You don't see a lot of dots in Sasebe or Nogales or the other border towns where 58 miles of fence went up in 2007 and 2008. But there's a big cluster west of Sasebe, where Rick likely crossed.
These are very remote areas, and that's where the routes got pushed when it became much more difficult to cross in those major population areas.
This ocean of red dots, it's evidence the border wall and other security measures have funneled crossers to more dangerous routes. But as Scott was looking at the map, he wondered if Trump's wall could actually plug that funnel.
Would you be surprised if after this big wall goes up, you still saw results like this, the sea of red dots?
No, people will probably find ways around whatever obstructions are put in front of them. That being said, you know, if there was a barrier that's completely impassable, then maybe that would decrease the number of deaths here. Whether or not that's practical, whether or not that's affordable, you know, I have no idea.
I asked Ann Norris a similar question. What if there was a wall built across the entire border?
Do you think that something like that would have stopped Rick from coming?
No. No, absolutely not. Nope. They would have all heave-hoed each other over the wall somehow. They would have tied their shirts and pants together. He was desperate to get back to his son. Andrew, is that you?
Sorry, surprise.
I thought...
Yeah, exactly.
Andrew is 9 years old now.
That's a big wife.
And his mom says he looks just like his dad, with the same dimpled smile and ears that stick out. He has a wall of photos of his dad.
There was another photo of him.
On the shelf above his bed, swimming, fishing.
You can see the fish dangling from the line.
And holding him as a baby.
When you think about your dad, what image comes to mind?
I think of him now as like him standing there and just looking at me, always watching me.
That story from Reveal, Stan Alcorn, with reporting help from Scott Pham and Andrew Becker. Next week, we continue our look at how immigration policies are affecting families, this time in France, where a journalist responds to the refugee crisis there by helping migrants sneak across the border with a trek through the Alps. Don't miss it. Our theme music is by Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.